Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Good day. This is the making of the John Batchelor Show. And I see from our European headlines, we're having a heat wave. France is as hot as it has ever recorded. The same for London. And it sweeps down across northern Italy. That's been in place for some days. Remembering, of course, that our European brethren are not fully air-conditioned, as is the United States. And indeed, they live in older buildings that have been remodeled. But those older buildings are not conducive to cooling a place off in a heat wave at this. We're looking at more than 40 degrees centigrade recorded in southwest France. That's 104 Fahrenheit. 40 degrees is threatened in Milan again. London probably exceeds that. There are various measures. We're having a heat wave. It is summertime. I welcome my colleague and friend Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang. I mentioned that this heat wave may or may not be part of the early warning system for the meteorologists watching the Central Pacific. Why? El Nino. The trade winds weaken. El Nino rises 1 to 2 degrees above centigrade, above regular, normal. That warms the waters of the eastern Pacific, and that changes everything. The last El Nino year, 2015. However, because someone in charge of this script understands how to get the audience paying attention in the first act, this year is said to be at risk of becoming not only a super El Nino, that would be 2.5 degrees centigrade above normal, but a 3 degrees centigrade above normal. And that is now called Godzilla El Nino. Not yet. These are the months to decide. I don't know if the heat wave is indicative or a parallel event. I do know that the weather is going to become increasingly the topic. Better than war, and certainly better than the People's Republic of China's abuse of its citizens, in particular, Jimmy Lai. I welcome Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang, my colleague and co-host, and we're very pleased to bring on our colleague, Mark Clifford, the author of The Troublemaker, How Jimmy Lai Became a Billionaire, Hong Kong's Greatest Dissident and China's Fiercest Critic. I recommend the book to get the backstory on why man of my age, senior citizen, who has prospered throughout his whole life by helping others, is now in solitary somewhere in the bowels of the torture prison that is the People's Republic of China's penal code. And we are not looking to a happy end of this story. Mark, a very good day to you. And bring us up to date on where Jimmy is right now and what is the intentionality of the People's Republic of China with regard to Jimmy Lai? Good day to you.
Good day to you, John, and great to be back with you. Thanks, as always, for your interest. Well, Jimmy, on Monday, it was his 2000th day in prison, mostly in solitary confinement. Think back, when he went in, President Trump was in his first term. The U.S. was in Afghanistan. Russia had not yet started its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. It was a long time ago. Jimmy's been sitting in prison, mostly in solitary confinement. We actually do know where he is. He's in the Stanley Prison. It's a beautiful place, a beautiful view, if you happen to have a view. He doesn't. He's in a windowless cell. It's hot. It's in the 90s right now in 80s and 90s in Hong Kong. Very, very high humidity. And there's real concern that this man who's 78 years old is facing a very difficult summer health-wise. So that's kind of the update. He's, by all accounts, doing well mentally. But look, anybody's going to suffer for 5 years in solitary. And in your 70s, it's just that much harder.
We'll begin immediately. Gordon, I'll come to you right away to frame what is the concern here in the United States for Jimmy Lai's fate. How does it very much illustrate the poor relations between Beijing and Washington that Jimmy Lai remains imprisoned? You understand. And then we'll go to Mark for an update of Jimmy Lai's fate and other remarks about the People's Republic of China. Gentlemen, I'll begin immediately. Thank you. This is the making of the show, about to become the show itself, on a heat wave morning round the globe. 5, 4, and thank you, Mark. 3, 2, 1. I'm John Batchelor, Gordon Chang, at Gordon G. Chang, my colleague and co-host, and we're very pleased to welcome the author and keen observer of the geopolitics of Asia, Mark Clifford. The book is The Troublemaker, How Jimmy Lai Became a Billionaire, Hong Kong's Greatest Dissident, and China's Fiercest Critic. Gordon, I come to you to explain to the audience why Jimmy Lai is so critical for the peace of the earth, but also for understanding where the United States is with regard to the People's Republic of China. This is not hail fellow well met in some forbidden city garden with the two leaders exchanging flattery. This is hostile and threatening. Why do we need to know the fate of Jimmy Lai? Why is his life so critical to the success of the United States and its allies? Good day to you, Gordon.
Good day, John and Mark. Jimmy Lai is an inspiration to all who want freedom and democracy, especially with regard to China. He could have left Hong Kong. He knew he was going to be persecuted, and he certainly was. And as Mark has just told us, he has now spent more than 2,000 days in prison, Monday being that horrible anniversary. President Trump has raised Jimmy's plight with Xi Jinping. Xi Jinping has indicated that he will not let Jimmy go. I don't know if this is a negotiating tactic on China's part, but clearly it's in China's interest to let Jimmy go, because if he dies in prison, and that's a real possibility, then what we have is him becoming even more of a martyr and more of an inspiration to the Chinese people and to people around the world.
You have a question for our friend Mark, Gordon.
Mark, as we just were talking about, Xi Jinping has indicated that he is not going to let Jimmy Lai go. Why do you think the Chinese leader said that?
Yeah, well, this is according to President Trump, and thank you, Gordon and John, for your interest. President Trump, after his recent meeting in Beijing in May, indicated that he had spoken with Xi Jinping, the party secretary, about Jimmy, and that it would be difficult for Xi Jinping to let Jimmy out. Now, I don't think that Xi Jinping is worried about the National People's Congress pushing back or impeaching him because he's letting Jimmy out. I mean, it's preposterous to think that it would be difficult for Xi Jinping in any real sense. It's a matter of face at this point. Jimmy Lai personifies the most intense opposition in the form of one person that the Chinese Communist Party has seen in nearly 80 years of rule. He's a man with intense principles. He does what he thinks is right, even if it's at the cost of his potential cost of his life. He's got money. He's got influence. He had a media empire that employed almost 4,000 people at its peak. He's got a lot of international support. So the Chinese are afraid that by giving in to Jimmy, it would be effectively giving in to the opposition to the regime throughout the country.
Mark, I want to understand what Jimmy Lai's fate means to the people of Hong Kong. The city feels at this point in between being the free and prosperous capital of of all of East Asia to becoming just like another crushed Chinese city? Do the people of Hong Kong understand Jimmy Lai's fate may be their fate?
They absolutely. Look, Jimmy Lai was a controversial figure. He was a swashbuckling, larger-than-life guy who ran a very aggressive newspaper. A lot of people in Hong Kong didn't like him when he was running Apple, but they have a newfound appreciation for his willingness to suffer on their part. And we've seen some signs that even establishment newspapers and publications have snuck a certain sympathy for him into some of their coverage, because they realize if a guy who just wanted China to uphold its promises to the people of Hong Kong, if a guy like Jimmy Lai can go to jail with his wealth, his influence, his courage, then any of them can go to jail. So I think they take that lesson on board, but his fate is Hong Kong's fate.
And when you say Hong Kong's fate, so we're looking at the city struggling even more than it has already. Is that correct?
That's right. It seems that each month brings a new turn of the screw in terms of authorities' ability to basically throw anybody in jail for anything. The latest is that the chief executive, effectively the mayor, can decide that any case is a national security case. So we had a tragic fire late last year that killed 168 people. First of all, that fire never would have happened had Apple Daily still been around. If you'd had a robust press, residents had protested and tried to talk to officials and the press for many months, and their calls went unheeded. Their warnings about safety issues, and then this huge apartment complex went up in flames. Now that's a national security case. Anybody who's trying to grieve and get justice for their loved ones risks, and they either have been people arrested and charged on sedition and other national security charges. The whole place is becoming a national security state.
Gordon, there's a spy case in London. Do you know about these things?
Well, Mark certainly does. It's a Hong Kong person. And again, it's part of China's comprehensive program to use everybody and everything to gather information for China.
Mark, can you explain to us, this is two men, one a British immigration officer. What do we know about this case, and what does it illustrate about China?
Well, it illustrates that China is using Hong Kong as a kind of cat's paw to see how far it can go in undercutting freedoms in democratic societies. The case revolves around the Hong Kong Economic and Trade Office, which is kind of a consulate or an embassy, supposed to be promoting trade and economic ties. In fact, it's become a spy and espionage den. A former Hong Kong policeman, Bill Yun, was appointed as a manager at the office. He recruited a man named Peter Wai, who, as Gordon mentioned, was a border forces official, immigration official for Britain. They, along with at least one other person who has ended up dead, an apparent suicide, were harassing and surveilling Hong Kong dissidents and others in England as part of a campaign to intimidate opponents at home and abroad. They were convicted and last week sentenced to 10 years and 8 years in prison. The longer sentence was for the border forces official who was abusing British databases to gather information, not just on Hong Kongers, but on others as well. It's a dramatic and a chilling illustration of China's export of its repressive policies. And the fact that it's very sad that Hong Kong is leading the way in this rather unfortunate endeavor.
So not only Jimmy Lai, a British citizen with British passport, is persecuted in China. They're using China's using its access to a free society, London, to abuse the people of London. Do I say that correctly, Mark? We've got
absolutely. I think, and John, thank you for underscoring and making this, really blunt. China and using Hong Kong as a proxy is exporting its repressive model. I have a young colleague, Chloe Chung. She just turned 21 earlier this year. She has a $130,000 U.S. dollar bounty on her head simply for her activities that she's conducted on behalf of people in Hong Kong, in the UK, in England. She moved to Leeds when she was a 15-year-old student. She wasn't active in Hong Kong, and yet the Hong Kong authorities, starting with John Lee, the mayor, the chief executive, have said they'll hunt her and others like rats to the end of the earth, to the end of their lives. This is for free speech, peaceful free speech activities in England. Mm-hmm. I mean, the world needs to wake up to the threat of China and the use of Hong Kong as this proxy for intimidating people in free societies around the world.
Mark Clifford, Gordon Chang, I'm John Batchelor. Thank you, Mark. Very well said.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
I bit my tongue and did not say the White House is asleep. I left it alone.
Xi Jinping's coming back in September. We're going to try to wake him up. But thank you for all you do, John and
Thanks,
Gordon.
Mark. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Okay. Take care. Bye.
All right, Gordon. Rebecca's probably here. I have to check. I've got too many. I've got barking dogs and a construction site. I'll shoot myself later. Jesus.
You can't hear it, John.
Well, that's because I turned it down when they started to bark. Yeah, it's there. All right, Rebecca, here we go. Good morning, Rebecca. Thank you.
Glad to talk with you as always. Hi.
I'm reorganizing my brain here. I've got two barking dogs and a construction crew.
Oh, my.
Yeah. You want to know how to learn how to broadcast? Broadcast with that background, okay? I'll teach you to concentrate. Wonderful. All kinds of noise about the U.S. Navy being a success. Should we make some of that noise?
Before
Let's
we do that,
noise. Go ahead.
We should tell the audience that Rebecca is a star. She is in the trailer for a new documentary about the U.S. nuclear forces. And she is there front and center.
I don't know about these things, Gordon.
It's called The Watch.
The Watch. I taped that so long ago. Yes, that should be a wonderful series. Obviously, I haven't seen it, but they filmed at a lot of the nuclear bases and locations around the country, is my understanding. So,
all right.
The trailer is really good. And in the middle of the trailer, which is only like about 2.5-3 minutes, is Rebecca.
Why, thank you. I'm also in the intro for World War II with Tom Hanks, but it's a little clip.
That I didn't know.
Yeah. I filmed, it's 20 episodes. I'm in some of the back 10, talking about Normandy and the China, Burma, India theater and all that. It's a really lovely series, different, very different take on World War II. Very well done. I'm glad to be in the cast.
What is it? Is it a documentary?
It's a History Channel documentary titled literally World War II with Tom Hanks. He narrates, and they have a cast of about 50 historians, experts, et cetera, that talk you through from Poland. Wonderful opening episode all the way through to the end. Hmm. It dropped on Memorial Day, but it's coming out, and now episodes coming out about once a week. And it's very well done. It was a very, very hot.
It's on one of the pay channels. Which one?
History. The History Channel.
Oh, History Channel.
Yeah.
When I pull up that screen, I can't tell anything because everybody's excited about whatever they're talking about.
Right.
I accidentally stumbled into a new movie. It's a theatrical presentation called Pressure, which I highly recommend. It looks at Normandy from the point of view of the weather channel, the weather call, whether there was going to be good conditions or bad conditions on the 5th and 6th. And they turned it into an exciting drama. And it's not quite exactly history because you have to condense some events, but it's a wonderful presentation of the risk that Eisenhower took.
Oh, that does sound great. I'm an Eisenhower fan. And John, I want you to know, I did watch The Final Countdown recently and loved it. But Gordon, thank you for it's been a long time since The Watch, and I'm glad you told me of it. Thank you so much.
I'll come to you, Gordon, initially. You mentioned The Watch at the top, and then we'll turn to The Strait of Hormuz, okay?
Sure.
Here we go. 5. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you.
5, 4, 3. This is the making of the show, about to become the show itself. 5. Oh, and everybody understand, John approves of the pressure. It is a good lesson for those of you who were born somewhat after 1970. So So you didn't get it. You didn't get a whole lot of contemporary history, I know, in the high schools of the late 20th century. Pressure is a good presentation of what we're talking about when we worry about the U.S. military readiness and the capabilities of our allies. It's a very good presentation. Working with allies is not straightforward. It requires a gift, and Eisenhower had that gift. 5, 4, and we wish we could get him back. 3, 2, 1. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang, and we're very pleased to speak to our colleague Rebecca Grant, the Vice President of the Lexington Institute. We're going to speak about contemporary matters 2026, but Gordon, you have remarks about Rebecca and the 20th century history as well. Please tell me.
Well, the great Rebecca Grant is featured in a teaser for a documentary on America's nuclear triad, and she's front and center. Also in that teaser is a B-52 pilot who unfortunately died in that crash a week ago. This is a very important documentary, and I recommend that everybody see it because it shows this is what protects the United States day in and day out, because day in and day out, we do use our nuclear weapons. We don't detonate them, but we use them to protect our country and our friends and partners.
What's it called again, Gordon?
The Watch.
And where can they find it? On video?
I believe it is Amazon Prime.
That's everything. Wonderful. Rebecca, welcome. Please tell us what you did for The Watch, and then we'll move right to the Strait of Hormuz.
Oh, John, Gordon, so many Americans have given their lives for American nuclear deterrence in that B-52 force. Of course, that is the triad, our submarines, our intercontinental ballistic missiles, and our B-52s. And the documentary crew for The Watch obtained permission to film at actual locations where nuclear weapons are at the ready to deter. And so it's going to be a wonderful series. I think everybody should watch it.
Strait of Hormuz, 2026. Okay. Iran says the Strait of Hormuz is shut. Is that accurate? How do they know, Rebecca? And by the way, isn't the U.S. Navy sort of in their way?
Even the U.N. says in a notice to mariners, the strait is open. There are active mine clearance operations underway. And watch out, there's one mine over here, and here's the lat long. But the strait is open, and Iran has no tactical control of the strait. They used to be able to send out fast boats, et cetera, but this is no more, thanks partly to Operation Epic Fury and then to some very quiet, intensive work by U.S. Central Command and the U.S. Navy to carry out mine clearance operations and get the Omani side channels open. The strait is open. Over 60 ships moved through that strait over the weekend. Pretty impressive.
Gordon, you have a question.
Rebecca, the U.S. Navy is still on station at the Strait of Hormuz along that line south of the strait. Is it going to be difficult for the U.S. Navy to maintain that presence over a long period?
They are still there, and destroyers like USS Delbert Black have been out since January. She left her home port in Florida way back in that time frame. You know, I have no doubt the U.S. Navy can keep this up as long as they need to. They can return to blockading if it calls for it. But make no mistake, this is a tremendous effort. And what you've got is of course, the two aircraft carriers in the North Arabian Gulf, destroyers, other ships like the littoral class ships that have the mine countermeasures packages. Then you've got literally Apache helicopters that are armed to go after drones that are patrolling the strait. They're there also to go after fast boats as necessary. F-16s, A-10s, the carrier-based air, the land-based air, you name it. Nobody went home from Central Command, and I don't think anybody will until that 60-day countdown is ended. Then we'll either see an agreement with Iran, or we may see more U.S. Navy operations.
I believe it was Reuters that revealed that there was a smuggler's route being used by the U.S. Navy and tankers coming out of the Gulf, the Strait, that was not much advertised early in the conflict, but certainly is now. And I think the Apache helicopter that was taken down by Iran fire was participating in that smuggler's route. Reuters called it a smuggler's route. I don't. It's more romantic that way. I think it's on the western shore of the Strait of Hormuz. And the U.S. Navy is participating in that. So when it's not only open, the U.S. Navy has control of the Strait of Hormuz. Does that generalities hold up?
That is exactly right. The U.S. Navy has control of the strait and that narrow passage. They have control of the sea lanes around it and up through the Gulf. And of course, we have air dominance over that region as well. And you're right about the Apache helicopters. The route, how romantic a smuggler's route, it's really the traffic separation scheme that runs by Oman. It's kind of like a big inbound, outbound lane. They're about 2 miles wide. There is another little route that goes even closer to that western coast you've talked about. But what we're wanting to see is the big ships, the VLCCs carrying crude, the bulkers, the container ships actually moving through the regular traffic separation scheme, because you've got northbound and southbound traffic you got to get through there. The problem is the international shippers, they work on very tight time schedules. They are extremely risk averse. The crews are unarmed for the most part, and it's going to take some time to get this traffic flowing. So President Trump needs to do everything he can to signal confidence in this waterway. And frankly, I think he ought to lift his Jones Act waiver. That would be a good signal to the international mirrors that the crisis is over.
What's that mean, Jones Act, Rebecca?
The Jones Act protects coastwise trade for U.S.-only ships, got to be U.S.-owned, flagged, and crewed. And they do things like run fuel from Louisiana into Florida and other supply routes. Under the waiver, foreign crews could participate in that, but only about 100 ships have done so. Although, Gordon, about a quarter of those turned out to be Chinese. So we normally just waive it for a little while during a hurricane. But this waiver has been in place for coming up on 90 days. And I think just sending a bad signal at this point. We want to protect that for U.S. ships only. That's the way forward for innovation and restoring American shipbuilding. So it's really time to cancel that waiver, partly to signal to the international shippers that we think everything is good in the Strait of Hormuz and we're not going to see that clog in the gasoline delivery system.
Gordon, we have about a minute for a quick question.
Rebecca, when we go back a year or so ago, people were talking about how the U.S. Navy had let its mine-clearing operations abilities to atrophy. How's that going now?
Well, as it turns out, we've got great mine clearance abilities. Fewer ships, but it's done now with underwater and surface autonomous vessels and with helicopters that use a sort of an aerial pod. It's all about detecting, locating the mine, and then neutralizing them when necessary. But most of that has now shipped to sea drones, which are an increasingly important part of the U.S. Navy.
Rebecca, your estimation right now, the Strait of Hormuz is open, the U.S. Navy has control. How much longer do you think Iran can get away with this magic trick of claiming they've shut it down?
No one's going to believe them. And you can't pay the Persian Gulf Strait Authority they set up because Secretary of the Treasury Scott Bessent put secondary sanctions on it. They're going to get no money. They can't run out a drone or a fast boat. No one is going to believe this could be Iran control of the strait. It's a desperate plea. It's not going to work.
And the word is going out now to all parties that the strait is open and that Iran is boasting. Is that correct?
Absolutely. You're listening to Channel 16 for the Mariners. Iran is boasting. But what we see is all the international maritime organizations saying, yes, here is the clear passage through the strait. And we can give you the lat long and the coordinates of where that channel is.
Rebecca Grant, Vice President of the Lexington Institute and featured in The Watch, a new presentation on the History Channel. And Gordon is correct. Everything's at Amazon. I'm John Batchelor. Wonderful, Grant. Rebecca.
Thank you both. That was great. I'm sure we'll be talking again about Iran and the strait, but they're done for.
I'll be looking for The Watch as well. We'll
continue. Yes. Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Cheers.
Oh, Gordon. Okay. Charles, good day to you.
Good morning.
I remind myself, a professional, it's not that we don't get exasperated. It's that we get up after getting exasperated and do it again. I'm living with a construction site and two spaniels that want to bark.
I don't know. The spaniels sound all right. The construction site, I'm not so sure.
Well, it's a challenge to broadcasting, to be able to broadcast inside a construction site. So if you hear any hammering or buzz sawing or me going or me moaning because something just fell, that's what's driving it. Enough about me. Let's talk about where we're headed. Gordon, I asked Gordon just a moment with Charles. I asked Gordon before a question that's come up these last days. Is it significant that Xi Jinping, the only trip he's made outside of the Chinese borders, or really the Forbidden City this year, is to Pyongyang? Does that signal anything? Does that show anything? Or is it just arbitrary, Charles, in your measure?
Oh, I think it's certainly not arbitrary. You know, he hasn't really left the territory, the contiguous territory of the People's Republic of China. You know, so, and certainly trying to assert Chinese sovereignty over North Korea is important. But no, he doesn't travel anymore. You know, we used to expect the Chinese leader to show up in Canada every 2 years. And of course, Xi Jinping is not doing that. So it is probably indicative of his concern about leaving the country for any length of time. Historically, that hasn't gone well for dictators and failing economies.
And the visit to our youthful friend who will be a dictator for decades yet, is that significant?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, I think that the Chinese want to ensure that North Korea is reminded that the Chinese are in charge. So I think that, that's significant. Normally, the normal procedure is for the younger brother to visit the elder brother and the North Korean leader to go to Beijing. But periodically, the senior brother has to go. And I mean, it follows a pattern. But, you know, and it, remembering in 1989 that Zhao Ziyang, the premier of the State Council, was purged when he made an ill-considered visit, timingly, to North Korea. By the time he got back, he was toast. So I was a bit surprised that Xi Jinping went, and just because of our previous discussions, that's really not a good idea for him to leave Zhongnanhai unattended.
Okay, we'll start right away with Canadians polled about China. What a surprise. Mr. Carney must take this into account as he goes forward, I hope, I think.
I don't think so.
Well, we'll come to that. Here we go. Five. This is the making of the show, about to become the show itself. Long as I get away with this. Five. We have two segments, so we can attend other matters as well.
Okay.
Five, four. But I'm going to start with the Canadian poll, the Toronto Sun. Mm-hmm. Five, four, three, two, one. I'm John Batchelor, Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang, my colleague and co-host, and we're headed north of the border, an unguarded border, the longest unguarded border in the solar system, Canada, and our friend Charles Burton of the Synopsis Institute, looking at a poll in the Toronto Sun that makes it very clear Canadians are well educated about the People's Republic of China. Charles, what I'm reading here is that the majority of Canadians see China as a threat. Is that new? Has that always been in place? I didn't know about it. Good day to you, Charles.
A good day. Well, I mean, in recent years, the perception of China as a threat to Canada has been enhanced. People are more aware of it. There was a major study of the government on Chinese interference in Canadian elections and influence operations that was provoked by the release of Canadian Security Intelligence Service secret documents that suggested that China was engaged in a lot of malign activities threatening Canadian security and sovereignty, that these documents had been given to the senior levels of government to act on, and the government had not responded to these threats. So, you know, that led to us a surge of Canadian concern over Chinese activities in Canada and the increase of China's presence. This survey was in fact done by the Canadian Security Intelligence Service to assess the extent to which Canadians are aware of these threats that the Security Service, of course, is very closely aware of. And it shows that if you ask people if China is a threat, they agree. But on the other hand, a significant portion of the Canadian population supports Mr. Carney's move towards improving relations with China in the hope of being able to diversify Canadian trade, which has been affected by the Trump tariffs, towards other countries. So on the one hand, they say that they're concerned about the Chinese threat. On the other hand, they'd like to do much more with China and are more or less giving China tacit consent over its influence and interference activities, over the import of products of forced labor, and the government's weakening of our stance against Chinese technology by the Huawei and ZTE companies. So you do have some contradictory indications there. But then you have to look at some other polling data, for example, that 65% of the Canadian population now believe that the United States is not a reliable partner. This in contrast to 83% 3 years ago, who thought that the United States was a reliable partner, or the only 20% of the population that believes that Mr. Trump is defending world peace and stability, as opposed to 59% for Macron and 83% for Zelensky. So, you know, it really is all about Donald Trump and the response to Canadian concerns over his policies that will negatively impact on Canada's economy and the pre-existing security arrangements, both in the North and with regard to NATO.
Gordon, you have a question for Charles.
Charles, with regard to U.S.-Canada trade, there are going to be negotiations about the USMCA, the Tri-National Pact, and also involving Mexico. How is that going at the moment?
Well, we're not having any, we're not having any negotiations. The United States has been dealing bilaterally with Mexico. Mr. Trump says that he doesn't think that the United States needs this, what we refer to as CUSMA in Canada, the trilateral integration of the economies through free trade. But on the other hand, it's still in effect, so that the Trump tariffs have impacted on certain sectors where he has abrogated the agreement, in metals and other relatively minor parts, the auto sector, 20% tariff on that, but it's still in effect. So negotiations are ongoing. But after the Premier of Ontario released a video showing in the United States, showing Ronald Reagan speaking against tariffs and promoting free trade, Mr. Trump stopped the negotiations. And as far as we know, they're basically not resumed. And so where this will go is hard to say, but it can't be abrogated immediately. There is a process for withdrawal, but there are a lot of concerns in Canada that Mr. Trump might decide to abrogate it. I mean, I should point out that, you know, over 30 states, the United States have Canada as their major trading partner. So if this agreement collapses, it will also impact on economic efficiency towards a significant portion of the American population as well.
Charles, my memory is that there was some unfinished business with the previous government, Mr. Trudeau's government. As I recall it, and it might be out of order, the Canadian intelligence services were releasing information that very much illustrated that China was a hostile actor and that the Trudeau government was not responding in kind. And that was why leaking, I think it was called, out of Russia, out of Canadian intelligence. What happened to all those episodes? Was that ever resolved? I think there was an investigation underway.
There was a commission that was held where this was discussed. And in the course of the commission, Mr. Trudeau suggested that these reports were not accurate reports. In other words, that his intelligence and security service was not providing him with information that the government felt confident to act on. Of course, that does call into question that if you feel your intelligence service is not providing you with good information, wouldn't you want to replace the leader and get people in that will provide you with strong information? But, you know, there were things like request to engage in surveillance of members of the Liberal Party, or at least one member of the Liberal Party that was seen as acting as an agent of the Chinese state. And this sat in a drawer for 50 days and wasn't acted on, that the minister's office didn't respond. So there were a lot of reports that came out that should have evoked response that did not evoke response. It certainly was very good in terms of my own credibility, because I'd been suggesting that these things were going on based on circumstantial evidence, and this proved that what I'd been writing about in the newspaper was certainly right. Doesn't seem to have made much difference. Canada subsequently enacted legislation to establish a foreign agents registry. That legislation was passed through Parliament unanimously in June 2024. Up to now, no registry has been implemented by the government. So there is concern that that there are elements within the Canadian regime that are actively resisting the information that is very clear, that China is a very hostile actor whose continuous infiltration of Canada is not being challenged by government policy. It's a major, major concern. And the number of Chinese diplomats in Canada, according to statistics, is just one less than the total number of Chinese diplomats accredited to the United States of America, a country with 10 times the population.
Mr. Carney's government, have they commented on these matters? It's their party, and there would be continuity if he did comment.
He has not. The suggestion is that the registry is coming, but they're very hard to set up. A commissioner was appointed, but months later, the appointment has not gone through cabinet and order of council, so he's not in place. None of this seems to have led to any changes in the Canadian government approach. And what we're seeing from Mr. Carney is much more appeasement of the Chinese regime than we saw under Mr. Trudeau. And I think because of the Canadian population's tolerance for Canada compromising with a view to trying to salvage the economy from the perception of U.S. Assault on Canadian prosperity, there's the pro-China elements among the co-opted elite and business elements are able to act with even more free rein than before. And the government came up with an agreement with Mr. Xi Jinping that we would not be raising these concerns about espionage and infiltration and election interference publicly anymore. And so the government suggests that the best way to deal with it is behind closed doors, and therefore it's been removed from the national debate because cabinet ministers will not engage on these issues.
Gordon, if this was a movie we were watching, you and I would come to the conclusion that the Liberal Party had been penetrated by Chinese agents. I know I'm exaggerating, but how else to think about this matter that it's left just not resolved?
Yes, and I think the United States should consider publicly talking about whether Canada should remain in the Five Eyes intelligence sharing consortium. We share our most sensitive intelligence over that consortium, and Canada in it seems to me to be a risk. I don't know what the proper answer is, but we need to have a public debate about Canada's participation in this.
We're going to speak well of Canada. Yes, right now. Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang and Charles Burton of the Synopsis Institute joins us because we're going to Manila, the Philippines, and the Pacific Rim shares something of a concern for the Chinese threat. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with Gordon Chang and Charles Burton of the Synopsis Institute. The headline tells the story. Philippines to build closer defense ties to Canada as it squares off with China. What does this mean, Gordon?
Well, this means that despite everything, that at least we're seeing in free societies start to mold and work together because they see China as a common enemy. China is pressuring the Philippines, especially at Scarborough Shoal. This is the most dangerous hotspot in the world that is not currently embroiled in war. And it's important for the United States, Canada, and others to work with the Philippines to deter China from what could very well be a confrontation that spirals out of control?
Charles, quite different from how I was pursuing before the questions about the Liberal Party. This looks to be shrewd and aggressive. Is that the way it's understood in Canada?
I think so. I mean, Canada is, as part of the desire to diversify economic dependence away from the United States, is negotiating a free trade agreement with the Philippines, part of Canada's overall desire to try and get less dependence on an uncertain U.S. situation. So Canada would like to be that those negotiations should complete this year. It seemed to be going quite smoothly. Canada would like to be selling a lot more liquefied natural gas to the Philippines. And then in terms of security, Canada has been quite strong in particularly in interdiction of these vessels that turn off their transponders, dark vessels, which are illegally fishing, for one thing, and also because of the Chinese vessels that are challenging the sovereignty of the Philippines. You know, the Philippines with 1,800 islands really needs access to the maritime resources roundabout. The other issue, which is quite significant for Canada, was the Philippines' action at the Court of Arbitration in The Hague to affirm the validity of the United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea, which suggested that the China's claims to waters very far from the Chinese land and very close to the Philippines are invalid. Canada, of course, has concerns about maintaining sovereignty in the Arctic and would like to see the United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea affirmed. So that's another significant aspect. But Canada has signed a logistical agreement with the Philippines for allowing Canadian troops to train on Philippine soil, fuel and interoperability of equipment, and did participate in the most recent Philippines military exercise. So Canada is certainly doing the right thing in the Philippines, and it's surprising in terms of the government's other actions or non-actions to appease the Chinese regime that the Canadian government is being so doing so much of the right thing with regard to a democratic ally that's meeting a challenge of Chinese expansionism.
Gordon, you have a comment and question for Charles.
Charles, you mentioned the Arctic, where China and Russia are pressuring both the United States and Canada. What is the state of Canada-America cooperation in the Arctic at this moment?
Not looking good. But the British have come up. The British have been assisting in the Arctic. Of course, the United States does have Alaska, which is far over to the west. But, you know, I think it's in general part of the Trump's government's requirement that countries should defend themselves and not be highly dependent on the United States. So the Arctic fits into the same pattern as the United States' reluctance to be as supportive of NATO as they were before. And Canada is responding to this, at least in rhetoric, in terms of promising to increase our presence in the Arctic and increase defense expenditure significantly. But practically speaking, due to decades of neglect and the expectation that the United States would step up if there was a challenge to the Arctic is essentially unprotected, and Russia, with Chinese support, is much accelerating its strategic reach into the Arctic at a much higher rate than Canada and the United States are.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Charles, because we're looking at a story. Yes, Canada might be late to the dance, but it is a major factor when it comes to the defense of the North. Mr. Carney made extravagant statements, as I recall, during the campaign. Is that being acted upon? Is he looking for the money in Parliament?
Yes, I mean, he's promised to eventually increase our defense expenditures up to 5%. But, you know, these promises occur over many years. And historically, Canadian governments have promised to enhance defense of the Arctic, and it hasn't come about even under the Harper period. So we'll believe it when we see it. I mean, right now, a lot of the Arctic defense is Inuit on snowmobiles observing things, and concerns about Chinese surveillance buoys, which have been dropped, which are found in Canadian waters. It not speak of the very active Chinese mapping of the Northwest Passage, which has been done with Canadian permission as a so-called scientific expedition. China's been mapped more of the of those waters than Canada has.
Gordon, I have a question for Charles.
Since you're talking about the Northwest Passage, the United States believes it's international water. Canada does not. Any movement on either position on the Northwest Passage?
Not that I've heard. I mean, the United States has passed submarines through it, you know, over the years, sometimes advising the Canadians in advance and sometimes not. But I don't think that there's any I don't think that there's any midpoint of this. U.S. sees it in international waters. Canada has arguments about ocean shelves that suggest it isn't. I haven't heard of any discussions that would productively resolve this discontent. But the main thing is that we don't want the Chinese and the Russians there. The concern about the U.S. is a lesser concern, and certainly Canada should invest in having icebreakers and submarines that can assert the Canadian sovereignty over these waters. It's one of these things, use it or lose it. And Canada is certainly hasn't stepped up to now to show that this is part of Canada's national sovereignty.
Connecting these two stories, the Canadian public understanding that China's a threat and the Carney government connecting to the Philippines that is under siege right now, Charles. The Scarborough Shoal is being compromised by the PLA Navy. This suggests that Mr. Carney may be behind the public in understanding the scale of this. I'm confused, though, by the Philippines embassy. That's a smart move on his part. Has he talked about it? We have about a minute.
I haven't heard Mr. Carney make any statements on the Philippines, but the Philippines foreign minister is expected to visit Canada next month, and I think there'll be further discussion. The way the Carney government's characterizing it is largely about trade diversification. They haven't, you know, they won't say anything that suggests that China is a threat publicly, although we certainly appreciate that. And 2.5% of the Canadian population is of Philippines origin. So there's a significant political aspect to this as well.
Charles Burton is at the Synopsis Institute. Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang. Ottawa in Manila. That's a great combo. I'm John Batchelor. I think it's smart, Charles. Really smart.
I don't think Carney knows about it. I think it's the military who's been, I really, whether he'll crack down and say stop doing this now that it's hit the press, it's another question.
That'll be a fun story. Who's ever running it knows what they're doing.
Yes, I mean, certainly. And I mean, it, we're talking about the peace of the world. And I think Canada's limited resources, but fairly strong sophistication in being able to track these dark vessels is significant. The other one is that they drag anchors and break undersea cables, because there's nothing like a fiber optic undersea cable to transmit information that cannot be compensated by Mr. Musk's Starlink. You know, the amount of data that's traveling across those cables will not be able to be compensated for by strengthening satellite communication to any degree at all.
My observation of the map, Charles, is that, let's see, I'll do Churchill's phrase, never so few have been depended upon by so many for so much. Northwest Passage, you own it, at least in terms of keeping it free of militarization and blockade. And there's nothing that China can do about it. Everybody would have to acknowledge that if you enforced it, your home waters. And
well, I mean, that is the question. I mean, isn't the state supposed to have the capacity to defend its borders? The thing is that the Canadian borders are enormous, and Canada just has not been doing this because the assumption has been that we can rely on the United States when push comes to shove. And a lot of Mr. Trump's rhetoric suggests that those days are over. And as Mr. Carney characterizes the relationship between Canada and the United States, he says it's in rupture. which a lot of people object to.
I have a recommendation. The new book from two New York Times reporters called Regime Change is out. You can read it now.
I've already ordered it. I thought it could give me some insight. I haven't opened it yet. It only came out on Kindle, I think, yesterday.
Yesterday, and I recommend it highly for the anecdotes, because everything Carney said is inadequate for the scale. But it's purposeful. The outrageous statements is purposeful to pull away from a defeat or a rebuke. Purposeful. Canada was used as a talking point to get away from trouble elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It will be used again. Same for USMCA. It's a style. Where did he learn the style? Roy Cohn.
Yes, that's, I think that, I think that it's got to the point where we really don't pay any attention to what Mr. Trump says.
We can't
rely that if he says something one day that he'll maintain it the next.
Well, here's the interpretation, not about the present regime, about the future. This is not something that's going to be deep inside American policy. You'd almost regard it as outside of policy. This is a rhetorical game, and it works in the media as long as the media pays attention. When it stops, nobody will miss it. And I recommend the book. You'll get the anecdotes right away. The outrageous statements about Canada were deliberate. They were meant to goad Canada, and it worked. So, and it continues to work.
But, I think that, the style of a leader is one thing. We had one of the greater Canadian prime ministers, a man called Mackenzie King. Subsequently, it was revealed that he sought advice in seances with his late mother and his former dog, Pat. But this, of course, wasn't publicly known at the time, but it doesn't seem to have negatively impacted on his governance quality, which was good. So, his personal life was obviously a bit weird in accordance with normal standards, but his prime ministership was a success.
Any man who depends upon a dog for advice is a smart man. That's it.
The dog was a late dog. It was not the, he wasn't talking to the dog that was actually at his feet. He was talking to the spirit of his dog.
Oh, I understand. It makes me go back and look at King again. I have a photograph of King coming out of Parliament with Churchill, and they both have huge grins on their face. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. Thank you, Charles. Gordon?
Thank you again. Yeah, take care.
A lot of fun this morning, especially the dead dog story, Gordon. You can't talk.
Take care. Bye.
Bye, Charles. Gordon, we meet again on Monday, if that's agreeable, or are we going
to
Sunday record?
Well, we just did Sunday because there are certain guests we can't get on Monday,
right?
Because they're on the other side of the country or whatever.
So, yeah, okay. So you're not traveling.
No, we weren't traveling. We just wanted to get Gertz because Gertz is hard to get if on a Monday.
Yeah, I understand. But if you need it, I just wanted to make it
clear. Oh, okay. Yeah, thanks.
If Lydia needs it. About the Philippines, I like that move. Do you like it, Gordon?
Yeah, it's a great move. It certainly shows that the relationship is stronger than it otherwise appears. There's an institutional strength to it.
Yeah, and things are going well on the other side of the Pacific Rim. Colombia is passing from the hands of Petro, who was friend of China, into the hands of El Tigre, and De La Esperia, who is not in a position to be friends of China. That's Colombia.
Right.
Ecuador is already Noboa. Argentina is a stand-up country turning away from China. And Venezuela's, the debts this morning to China are revealed. So China was exploiting Venezuela for some time.
Well, the red wave is over.
Yeah.
And so
China's looking at a Pacific Rim that's changing in posture. And now Canada has to be regarded as suspect of changing in posture to link up with the Philippines.
Yep.
Next thing they'll be running. I don't know that. That exercise the Navy's run in Asia every year.
RIMPAC.
Does Canada participate in that?
I'm 99% sure it does.
Okay. Well, thank you, Gordon, and thanks, Lydia. And we're off to the exciting Strait of Hormuz again. But it was good to hear from Rebecca that, you know, common sense says it's open. The only thing we're letting the mullahs do is say it's shut. Okay. Back it up, guys. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Let me go to the Roman Orchestra so we sail out of here on time. They demand overtime quickly, Gordon.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.